From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Economic indicators point to robust growth, yet according to a Washington Post ABC poll released last week, 59% of voters say they trust John Kerry more than incumbent President George W. Bush on the economy. Bit by bit, the presidential candidates are laying out their plans to create new jobs and reduce the deficit. Their visions for your pocketbook, your portfolio, your paycheck. Tonight on Point, Bush versus Kerry on the U.S. economy. But first, the U.S. Federal Reserve today left its key interest rate at 1%, a 46-year low. The Fed said economic activity is expanding at a solid pace, but that job growth is still weak. Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him how Chairman Alan Greenspan and the Federal Reserve decided to hold interest rates at 1958 levels.
Well, Tom, basically they said, look, we have a lot of unused factory capacity. We have a fair bit of unemployment, and inflation, frankly, is very low and appears to show no sign of going higher. And in those circumstances, there's really no urgency for us to raise interest rates, even though they are so low. And so they left them alone.
I'm reading here that the central bank said that the risks of a fall in inflation were almost equal to that of a climb in consumer prices, and that the chances of a pickup in economic growth and a downturn were roughly balanced. They make it sound like we're on a knife's edge here.
I know. They're basically saying that, look, we think things are okay. We think the economy is going to keep ticking along very well. We don't think there's much risk of deflation, and we certainly don't see much risk of inflation. So by and large, things look kind of balanced. Now, the time you would start expecting them to raise interest rates is when they start to signal through those statements that things are no longer balanced. For example, you could expect them to start saying, we think that the risks of inflation rising are, in fact, on the upside now, and we're not at all worried about inflation declining. And you might, in fact, see them say the risks on growth are on the upside. We think the economy could grow so fast that it will sort of grow beyond its bounds and start putting upward pressure on wages and prices.
Greg, all of this comes into the mounting temperature of a presidential campaign season. Let's just take, for starters, this sticking with the low inflation rate. How does that play into the political equation, Bush v. Kerry?
Well, you know, there's a widespread view out there that the Federal Reserve simply doesn't want to raise interest rates before the election. Some people think they don't want to raise rates because it would just attract a lot of unwanted attention. And some people think they wouldn't want to raise rates because, after all, Alan Greenspan is a Republican. He does want to be reappointed in June as chairman of the Federal Reserve by President Bush. And so leaving rates lower would help ensure that Bush gets reelected and, you know, do him a few favors along the way. I'm personally not so sure that the election will play that big a role in their decision. I think Greenspan's number one desire is to make sure that the economy does well and that they don't lose the tremendous progress they've made over the years on inflation. Now, it could perhaps shade them in the direction of maybe moving rates 1 month earlier or 1 month later. But in the scheme of things, I don't think politics will drive the decision. That said, I certainly expect people to accuse the Fed of having let politics drive its decision if, for example, it doesn't raise rates until 3 or 4 weeks after the election.
If the Fed would begin to kick interest rates up, what consequences might that have, which would be good or bad for George Bush's reelection?
Well, I think, first of all, you should realize that any increase in rates will not be happening in isolation. It will not drop out of the sky from the lords of the Federal Reserve and imposed upon us. They'll basically do it because the problems that we've seen for so long in the economy will be going away. Unemployment will be coming down. Jobs will be created, and perhaps inflation will be starting to nudge a little bit higher. Those are all signs of a very healthy economy. And so against that backdrop, I think the news of the Federal Reserve raising interest rates actually won't mean that much for the president's reelection chances, because really what voters will be looking at is all these positive economic trends which are driving the Fed to raise interest rates.
The stock market is another indicator that the president likes to keep, any president likes to keep healthy in advance of his reelection. What's the interaction now between interest rates and stock prices?
That's a very good question, Tom. There's a lot of people out there worrying that investors who, of course, were gripped years ago by irrational exuberance, as Greenspan put it at the time, are getting a little bit irrational again. We've seen very big gains in stock prices in the last year, although they've come down a lot in the last week, partly because of the tragedy in Madrid. We've seen a lot of frothiness in other parts of the markets, such as for corporate bonds and bonds issued by risky developing countries. And, of course, as everybody practically knows, the housing market is so strong that a lot of people think that we have a housing bubble on our hands. So I think that one of the risks that the Fed runs when it finally starts to raise interest rates is that there could be a very sudden pullback in a lot of these markets by investors or people who got used to low interest rates and really didn't see the increase in interest rates coming.
There's talk out there today and in recent days, Greg, that Alan Greenspan has shifted his thinking about borrowing and inflation and that he thinks the economy can live with more of each than he did in the past. Do you see evidence of that?
Well, Tom, I think it's certainly true that over the years, Greenspan has become more comfortable with the notion of the private sector, that is to say people like you and me, and businesses borrowing more, because he sees evidence that they have instruments available to them in the markets and that enable them to carry more debt comfortably. But he has always been allergic to governments borrowing money, and that I don't think has really changed. The one time he stepped out of form really was 3 years ago when he, as we all probably remember, endorsed the notion of tax cuts. But remember why he did it. It's because we had at the time a surplus, and hard to believe as it is now, he actually worried that eventually the government would pay down all its debt and then start buying up pieces of corporate America with the extra money it had on its hands. I think the more intriguing issue is that he continues to believe that we should stick with the tax cuts the president gave us, even though that surplus that we talked about 3 years ago has completely disappeared and been replaced by gigantic deficits.
A very big change indeed. Greg, how old is Alan Greenspan now?
He's 78, just turned 78.
And is the expectation that he'll be reappointed by George Bush?
Well, Bush said sometime last year that he thought Greenspan deserved another term, and that term expires in June of this year. But there's an extra wrinkle. He gets a 4-year term as chairman, but some time ago he was appointed as a governor of the Federal Reserve, and his term as a governor actually expires in 2006. And unlike his term as a chairman, your term as a governor cannot be renewed. So if indeed the president follows through with his earlier promise and reappoints Greenspan later this year, at best, I think he can only serve another 2 years.
But for now, interest rates remain at historic low levels, and Alan Greenspan remains in the saddle. Greg Ipp, thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. John Kerry and George W. Bush are campaigning on their economic plans, but sorting out who stands for what can be tricky. Bush wants to make his tax cuts permanent. Kerry wants to raise taxes on higher-income Americans. Bush supports free trade, but the steel tariffs he imposed and then repealed cloud his record. Kerry has a long history of voting like a free trader, but can sound like a protectionist these days as he rails against job losses on the campaign trail. Bush says he will rein in spending, but he certainly hasn't done it. Kerry promises to slash the deficit, but provides few details on how. Tonight on Point, we are sorting out the plans of Bush versus Kerry on the U.S. economy. Will the economy make the difference in this year's presidential showdown? Will you be voting your pocketbook? Does a Kerry economy sound better or worse to you than a Bush economy? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Jim McTagg, Washington editor at Barron's Magazine. His most recent article is Turnabout, Which Party is Better for the Markets? Kerry and Bush are changing the rules. Good evening and welcome, Jim McTagg.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jim. It's a thorough and very interesting article you've put together here about how Republicans and Democrats may be changing roles on the economic front, at least as regards the market. What's the turnabout you're describing?
Well, historically, the Democrats have been much better for the stock market than the Republican. They have been the party of growth and higher interest rates. And you can go all the way back to 1929, and Democratic growth was 5.18% versus 1.69% for the Republican.
Mm-hmm.
This time around, it's Bush who is trying to stimulate the economy with his tax cuts and promoting growth. You know, we've had a boom in the stock market. And it's John Kerry who's coming in as the fiscal conservative who would pay down the deficit, and that would be better for bond investments.
Jim McTagg, we know there are many more ways of looking at the health of the economy than through the spectrum or the prism of the stock market. On the other hand, the things that stock market watchers pay attention to, we're all interested in, and in effect, the whole economy. I wish you'd kind of walk through what you see, or what the market, Wall Street, sees as the salient indicators of each of these two candidates' plans at this point. Key on the George Bush front, making tax cuts permanent, is that number one?
That's popular with Wall Street, especially the dividend and capital gain tax cuts. You know, talk of Curry's raising the marginal rates doesn't frighten Wall Street as much as perhaps. And Curry hasn't talked about this yet, but if he were to raise the rates on capital gains and dividends, they would find that to be very negative for the stock market.
Well, let's look at that for just a minute. Bush cut the top dividend tax to 15% from as high as 38.6% under Clinton, and the capital gains tax to 15% from 28%. Has there been any peep from the Kerry camp on what, whether or if he might do anything with those rates?
I talked to Roger Altman, who is one of Kerry's advisors.
A former Deputy Treasury Secretary under Clinton as well.
Yes, and he's now an investment banker in New York.
Okay.
He says that Curry really hasn't made up his mind yet concerning the dividend and capital gains rate. But, you know, Altman says, if it were up to me, there would be serious consideration of raising those rates for the wealthiest people. Now, as I point out in the story, the wealthy people may not be as rich as people think they are. They may not be as rich as people think they are.
Kerry tends to describe these as households making $200,000 and above.
And it's much less than that.
No, how do you say it's much less than that? What do you mean, it?
Well, Kerry would raise the two marginal rates, and there are six tax brackets. The fifth rate begins for individuals making $143,500 and for joint filers making $174,700. Now, in some places, that may be rich. I think in places like Boston and New York and Washington.
Lots of people would quibble with calling that rich.
Yeah.
Let's just look at that for a second. The tax rate, then, as you're describing it, as described by Altman, who's working with Kerry now, for the second highest income bracket would go from 33% back up to 36%, and for the top bracket would go to 36.9% from President Bush's 35%.
Yes. And then when you add in state taxes, it actually when you add in state taxes, it can go as high as 40%.
Jimmy,
the highest rate would be 39.6.
Right, Jim. Is that the fulcrum of Kerry's promise to balance the budget? Does it depend on those on taking those higher end tax rates back to those levels?
Yes, it does. And in fact, that's a theme you hear from their campaign, that they would restore the Bill Clinton tax increases. And, you know, in their reasoning, that would usher in another boom, another golden age.
As it did for Clinton. Bill Clinton raised upper-end tax rates in the early mid-90s.
Now there's argument, as I point out in my story. People on Wall Street say that when Clinton raised those taxes, it actually introduced a drag on the economy. And in fact, unemployment during the first 36 to 38 months of Clinton's administration, the rate of unemployment was much higher than it is now. And the argument on Wall Street is that when Newt Gingrich and the Republicans came along with their contract with America promising tax cuts for the middle class and a reduction in government, that triggered the boom.
Really uncorked the party there. What about the kind of bottom line on President Bush? Is it all happy days are here again from the Wall Street perspective, or do they have misgivings about the president's economic plans as well?
Well, yeah, this is really interesting. They have misgivings. I say it's interesting because I do this story every 4 years.
Yep.
And when I wrote the story when Clinton was first running, Wall Street just dumped on Clinton big time. You know, they said he would be the biggest disaster ever for the economy. And, of course, he ushered in what looks like a golden age. This time around, they're really hedging. They're really not strongly endorsing one candidate or the other. I'd say they're leaning to Bush because they like those tax cuts.
But it's not necessarily hands down, and the public has got all kinds of opinions on this. Jim McTagg, stand by. We're talking tonight about Bush versus Kerry on the U.S. economy. You can join this conversation. Will the economy make the difference in this year's presidential showdown? Will you be voting your pocketbook? How would you characterize the Bush approach to the U.S. economy? Has it worked for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Bush versus Kerry on the U.S. economy. Two candidates for the White House, two plans for the economy. You can join our conversation tonight. How would you characterize the Bush approach to the U.S. economy? Has it worked for you? And what would you expect from a Kerry administration on the economy? Does a Kerry economy look better or worse to you than Bush country? And what's your vote? Taxes up or taxes down? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Jim McTagg. He's Washington editor for Barron's Magazine. He joins us tonight from Montgomery Village, Maryland. We're joined right now from New York by Jason Furman. He advises the Kerry campaign on economic policy. He's former policy director for Wesley Clark's presidential campaign. He served as a special assistant to the president for economic policy during the Clinton administration and a senior economic advisor to Al Gore's presidential campaign. He's lectured at Yale and Columbia. Good evening and welcome, Jason Furman.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's great for having you on. And joining us tonight from Stanford, California, research fellow at the Hoover Institution, David Henderson. He's a former senior economist on President Reagan's Council on Economic Advisors. He's author of The Joy of Freedom, An Economist's Odyssey. Good evening and welcome, David Henderson.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for joining us. I guess, Jason Furman, you're in the challengers camp, so we'll have to go to you first. How do you see the fundamental Kerry critique of the Bush economy, and what would John Kerry do about it?
The fundamental critique that Senator Kerry has made of the Bush economy is the absolute failure to get job growth going again. The economy's lost 2.2 million jobs in total under President Bush. That's the worst job loss record of any president since President Hoover. And for private sector, it's actually worse. You've lost 2.9 million private sector jobs while the government's done reasonably well in terms of creating jobs in the last 3.5 years. And Senator Kerry's proposals go directly at that issue with a set of tax cuts for companies, manufacturing companies, that create new jobs, and ending tax breaks for companies that create jobs or move jobs overseas. So he's very focused on job creation.
But Jason Furman, we already have the sense that American corporations are not exactly overtaxed. Is there a crying need for tax breaks to keep American jobs in the United States?
I think the central issue for Senator Kerry is not, as you just characterized it in the introduction, a question of whether he wants to raise taxes and President Bush wants to cut taxes. That's not Senator Kerry's economic plan. His economic plan is to cut taxes for companies that are creating jobs. The idea is for a temporary 2-year period, if a manufacturing firm hires a worker, they'll get a tax credit to cover the payroll taxes.
But Jim McTagg says that raising those higher-end personal income tax rates is critical to John Kerry's promise to balance the budget.
That's true. I would talk about two parts to the Kerry economic plan. One is that we have an immediate crisis, which is that the economy isn't creating jobs. Mm-hmm. And we have to address that. And we need that with a stimulus package that shifts money from ineffective stimulus. Tax cuts for the wealthy tend to be saved to a greater degree, not increase aggregate demand and expand the economy as much. Okay. Shift from those ineffective stimulus to more effective stimulus that provides fiscal relief for states, which right now are raising taxes and cutting services, and for companies that are creating jobs. So that's the first part of the plan, is a more effective stimulus.
Okay, let's just look at that to begin with. David Henderson, take a look out the White House window for us. How does the economy look from the Bush administration point of view? And what's the Bush reelection campaign's view, as you see it, of the John Kerry challenge, the John Kerry plan?
Well, I can't tell you what it looks like out from the White House. I'm looking outside of the beautiful Stanford campus right now.
Well, that window will do, as long as it's the Hoover Institution window.
Yeah. And let me just, it is, but let me just also say that I'm not a defender of Bush in total. I like his tax cuts, and there are a lot of things I don't like. So let me just, I just want to put that important hedge in there.
And I'd have to say you're hardly alone in that among conservative economists. Almost everyone we talk to on the conservative side says, well, we're in Bush's corner, but he hasn't exactly been orthodox, straight and narrow here.
Yeah, and I'm not even in his corner. In fact, can I just go back to the main question you asked about
Sure.
a Kerry economy versus Bush economy?
Mm-hmm.
I think in a way that's the wrong way to pose it. I think the real question is a Kerry Republican Congress economy or a Bush Republican Congress economy. And here's why I'm not so gung-ho on Bush is because what I look at with Clinton and the – I think that we had a golden age starting around 94, as your guest from Barron's said, 94,
yes.
95. And that also starts – that is the same timing as with the start of the Republican Congress. And so what we had was gridlock to some extent. They couldn't agree on a prescription drug benefit, and so they didn't get one. And what we have – Republicans tend to be much less of a discipline on their own party's president than they are on the other party's president.
Plenty of evidence right now. Plenty of evidence of that right now.
Yeah, and I if I were judging Bush alone versus Kerry alone on economics, not on war, where I'm more on Kerry's side, but on economics, I'd be on Bush's side. The problem is that we have to judge the result of a system, and the system has a Congress in there. And so I think that some of Kerry's worst ideas, like the increase in marginal tax rates, he won't get away with. And whereas some of Bush's worst ideas he would get away with, like the prescription drug benefit.
So interesting. So from a conservative point of view, you have misgivings about letting a Republican president team up with a Republican Congress. What about the central John Kerry taunt to the Bush White House that says, you may have had some stimulus out there, but it's the wrong kind of stimulus, and you're not making jobs? What do you see in a Bush reelection economic plan that might address that?
Well, here's the thing. I think that the jobs thing is not a way to judge it. I think the unemployment rate is a better way to judge it. I mean, if the unemployment rate is under 6%, something's working pretty well, and it is under 6%. So the fact that there aren't jobs created suggests that there are people who don't want to go out and find work, and that could be a demographic factor. That could be the aging of the baby boomers. That could be all kinds of things. And so I think the unemployment rate is a better measure of how we're doing on the jobs front than jobs per se.
So you'd say we're already doing all right there. Jason Furman, how about it? Is the central statistic of the Kerry critique bogus if you've got 5.6 unemployment? Is that just hunky-dory?
I think most observers think that there are substantial weaknesses in the job market. It's something that the Federal Reserve included in their statement today in explaining one of the reasons that they were keeping interest rates at a 40-year low of 1%. So I think almost everyone agrees that the job market is very weak. One way of looking at it is a number of people who chose to be in the labor force in the year 2000 when the economy was growing well have left the labor force. They're not even looking for work anymore. And the way we calculate the unemployment rate, if you're so discouraged you give up looking for a job, you don't count as unemployed.
Well,
if you adjust the unemployment rate, if the same number of people were looking, the participation rate, were participating in the economy, as was the case in the year 2000, the unemployment rate right now would be over 7%.
David Henderson, we hear this every time this dispute over this number comes up. What do you say?
Well, that's true, but the more relevant measure is the discouraged worker measure, which is 400,000 people. You know, that's the number that who've given up. And 400,000 out of a labor market of 130 million is 0.3%. So if we adjust it for that, it goes from 5.6 to 5.9.
Jim McTagg, step in here as a referee for us a little bit. The airwaves and newspapers and magazines of the country are full of concern about low job creation, about jobs going overseas, outsourcing, offshoring, and all the rest. Here you hear the fundamental kind of standoff between these two camps on exactly where we stand on jobs in the United States. Is it a credible core issue for the Kerry campaign or not?
You know, I don't know. I find it hard to believe because of my own experience. All I have four kids, one in college. They all have jobs.
Small sample, Jim.
I have in-laws that are carpenters and bricklayers. They all have jobs. They're usually the first ones laid off. I have friends in the Midwest and in the West, And they tell me the economy is going gangbusters out there.
And yet the Bush administration predicted what we'd be creating something like 200,000 jobs a month by this point. And that is about what was being created a decade ago when the Clinton years boom began, Jim. You know, those little numbers, what did we see last month? Something like 6 or 10,000 jobs created in January.
And they were all government jobs, too.
We don't have the entrepreneurial boom that we had under Clinton with the tech bubble and the capital. I think part of it is people got burned in the tech wreck, so they're a little bit more conservative in the new companies and ventures that they back, number one. Number two, productivity. People have been replaced by the computer. You know, when there's a recession, managers, you know, managers in good time always have excess people because they know when there's a recession, they're going to have to cut 10% of the workforce to please their bosses.
Yeah.
It's a jerky reaction. They cut 10% this time, but they never needed those people because of computers. And those people will never be able to come back to their old jobs. And that's a big problem.
David Henderson, get all your cards out on the table on this because this seems really important to understand. We're told again and again that just to keep up with American demographics, the economy needs to create something like 200,000 jobs a month. Now, if it's only creating 10 or 20,000, how can that not be a problem?
Well, because it's a judgment call that your first premise is the judgment call, that in order to keep up with demographics, it has to create 200,000 jobs a month. Not if a number of people decide not to go out and look for work, and it's not because they think they can't find it. In other words, you know, as we get wealthier, and we certainly have got wealthier, people will make choices, different choices about leisure and work and retirement and all those kinds of things. And that's why I'm not sitting here saying I know that this isn't a problem. I'm saying the best indicator we have has typically been the unemployment rate. Let's not just quickly drop it. You know, let's look at unemployment. Let's look at discouraged workers. And if those things aren't showing huge numbers, that's a pretty good indicator relative to these other very fuzzy numbers.
Jason Furman, so the unemployment rate's all right, and David Henderson suggests that some Americans are just sitting home eating bonbons. That they're fine. They're happy. They're it's posh city.
Let me say that.
Well, they don't have to work, and the economy has made them rich, you said, enough that they've made another choice.
Right.
Let me make three points about that. The first is, if you look at participation rates, even adjusted for demography, so you just take men between the age of 35 and 39, you've seen a dramatic reduction in those participation rates since the year 2000. It's hard – that can't be explained by demography. It's hard for me to believe that that's changed – the result of some large change in people's taste for work versus leisure. It seems to me like that's consistent with a very weak job market, so people are getting discouraged. A second point is there's been a debate over the employment statistics. Right now there's two ways of measuring the number of jobs.
Right.
One, you go out and ask companies how many people they hire. The other, you go out and survey people and ask how many of them are working. They're both telling a very different story right now. Economists have looked very hard at that, and in general, if you look at Alan Greenspan or the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they've concluded that the number where you go out and ask companies how many people they're hiring is a much more accurate measure at this point in time. And that's the one I cited, which shows the 2.2 million jobs lost under President Bush. The one where you ask households is the one where the 5.6% unemployment rate comes from, and it appears for some reason that we don't understand to be increasingly inaccurate. That brings you to the last question, which is why aren't we seeing jobs growing? And I think part of the explanation is that we've seen a tremendous increase in health costs since the year 2000. The premiums paid by families have gone up 49% in 3 years. What that does to a company is it makes them reluctant to hire an additional worker because they'll have to pay their health bill and, as a result, try to squeeze more work out of their existing workers.
So you think the Terry tax break for manufacturers might offset that and spark more hiring there?
Exactly. When you want to hire a worker, you have to pay a fixed cost. You're going to have to pay several thousand dollars for their health plan in order to hire that worker. If you give a tax break to offset each worker you hire, you get a couple thousand dollars tax break. It basically offsets the cost of those higher health care premiums. That's a temporary solution. You need a long-run solution, which is getting the health care costs in this country under control.
Let's hear the voices of citizens out in that economy. Chris is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Just great. Thanks, Chris. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been listening to this discussion you've had And all I can say is I'm a small business owner. I've got a business in Cincinnati, Ohio, and Lexington, Kentucky.
Terrific. How's it going?
And so we've survived the 9/11. We're beginning to see the benefits of the Bush tax cut, and we have this guy coming in and railing about the fact that jobs are not growing. I'm hiring people every day. I'm going to put 3 new people on in a company that's only got 8 to start with this spring.
That's a pretty big percentage jump.
Yes, it is. And it's all I think the economy is on the upswing. Jobs always lag behind all the other indicators. And yet you see the talking heads just screaming about the fact that the Bush economic plan is failing. I think it's succeeding admirably when you consider the absolute catastrophe that it had to suffer through, and still it's turned the economy around and we're moving upward.
Chris, hold on. Jason Furman, what do you say to this sounds like Bush voter who said, and small businessman who says it looks like it's working to him and he's going to be hiring big time?
Let me say, first of all, that Senator Kerry's plan includes tax cuts for companies like yours that are creating jobs. The issue is not whether taxes are higher or lower, but whether you use your tax system to encourage job creation. And that is what Senator Kerry is proposing. There's no question the economy has been subject to a series of adverse shocks that were beyond the president's control in the last several years. The question is what the best thing to do about it is now, how most effectively to stimulate the economy in a way that's really focused on creating jobs.
Chris, let me ask you, would you rather see an income tax break for you and other Americans or a tax break for your business?
Quite frankly, I don't really care one way or the other. I want to see the economy turn, and I've seen this president make that effort to turn that economy. I mean, the Clinton economy was starting to sag when he left office, and Bush inherited that recession that came out of the Clinton administration.
Right, and from where you sit, he turned it around pretty well. Chris, thanks very much for your call. David Henderson, what grade do you give President Bush on the turnaround, given the recession that was coming at him as he came into office?
Well, I don't know. I don't even like to think that way because I just don't think a president on his own does that much.
Mm-hmm.
I think the grade I would give is a very high grade, at say a B+ or more to the U.S. economy, because it's just so resilient. It can bounce back from so many shocks, and that's what we've seen many other times, and we're seeing it again. But could I just address this whole job creation thing and the tax system and so on?
Please, we've got half a minute before the break,
well,
David.
Well, we've got this incredibly complex tax system, mm-hmm. and Senator Kerry's proposal would make it even more complex, and it would discriminate against people who are hiring lots of people because they haven't hired more people, and you know, I just think that's the wrong way to go with tax policy. The idea should be to get marginal rates even lower if we're going to make any moves on that, or at least simplify the tax system, and to kind of put together these Rube Goldberg schemes for, you know, that will cause people to game it in all kinds of ways. They might lay people off, and then they'll hire them back, and that way it counts as a new hire, and all these things. And I know that tax writers like Jason will anticipate it, and they'll put in all these things, and that'll make it even more complicated.
David Henderson, stand by with that thought. We'll come back and look at it. Jim McTagg, Jason Furman, David Henderson, you can join the conversation. Do we have a real fork in the road here or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Bush versus Kerry on the economy. Two candidates for the White House, two plans for the U.S. economy. We're joined tonight by Jim McTagg, Washington editor for Barron's Magazine. From New York by Jason Furman. He advises the Kerry campaign on economic policy. And from Stanford, California by David Henderson, research fellow at the Hoover Institution. You can join us as well. Will the economy make the difference in this year's presidential showdown? And how would you describe the fundamental instincts of Bush on the economy, of Kerry on the economy? Can any president really make a difference, or is it all about you? Is it all about the U.S. economy itself? Manny is calling from Boston. Hi, Manny. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Comments. I work in high-tech sector in a sales capacity.
Okay.
And one of the gentlemen on the West Coast made a comment that people are making different choices about working and not working. And I would have to say that he is terribly wrong. People want to work. Friends of mine have been out of work for over a year. Those that are employed are underemployed, having to take jobs that they could probably do in their sleep. And I don't really think that Bush has done anything except help his friends with this economy.
But, Manny, he's cut the tax rates a lot, which is supposed to be a stimulus. Everybody says so. What would you like to see a president do, if not that?
Well, show me where the jobs have been created, Tom. And the gentleman that created three jobs in Lexington, Kentucky, does not make a boom.
Well, but he's a small businessman. You take a million of those, and that's 3 million jobs and on.
Have we seen that number of jobs created? Or did you say, what was it, 6,000 last month?
It was a really pitiful number in January. There's no question about that. So you're saying, show me.
Exactly. We haven't seen anything. And all we've heard is rhetoric. But, you know, rhetoric doesn't create opportunity, doesn't create jobs. All it does is it sounds nice to the public, but anybody who's been out looking for a job or who's underemployed can't possibly believe Bush is going to do anything if he thinks this is prosperity. How can he justify that to somebody who's been out of work for over a year and that was earning, you know, well over $100,000 during the good times in technology? How can you justify
that? Manny, we hear you loud and clear, and we've heard that for the last year and more from callers right here. Jim McTagg, what do you say to Manny? And do you think this is a decisive voice of the American voter saying, wait a minute, it doesn't look so plump to me?
Yeah, Bush has a problem. As I point out in the story, I mean, the things he's, you know, the comeback of the stock market is a big positive. I mean, most people have money in stocks, so it's not so painful to look at your 401ks anymore. And if you own a house, your house is appreciated, so you feel richer. And yet, the tax cuts really haven't created the jobs yet. And it reminds me of Bush's father. Did you remember Nick Brady was Treasury Secretary?
Yep.
And he was saying back then there was a recession. He's saying the economy is recovering because the companies are producing more light bulbs. Do you remember that? And people laughed at him because he thought that light bulbs were a leading indicator of a recovery. Well, lo and behold, it was a leading indicator, but it didn't happen soon enough to save Bush's shirt. And this could happen to the sun.
Light bulbs do not cut paychecks. I want to look at this issue of trade, free trade, protectionism. Jason Furman, Jim McTagg is talking to Wall Street, and they have told him in his article in Barron's that Kerry, in spite of the fact that he has voted for every major free trade treaty since NAFTA in 1993, they hear him talking like a protectionist, an isolationist. Is that fair?
What Senator Kerry is doing is using the formula that was successfully used by President Clinton and Al Gore to greatly expand world trade and increase U.S. exports and the prosperity of America and the prosperity around the world.
But wait, Clinton didn't talk about people being traitors if they went and worked overseas. He said, let's compete.
What Clinton did, though, was made environmental agreements and labor agreements a central part of trade negotiations, and he made adjustment for workers that were adversely affected in America and training and helping workers compete better a central part of trade agreements. He didn't just go out and say, we want to unilaterally eliminate all of our tariffs. He said we have to work with other countries and do it in a way that works for our workers and
but
for the environment.
But we've still got those treaties, so if they've got such great protections built into them by Bill Clinton, why aren't they working now?
I think they are working.
You do, David Henderson?
Yeah, I do think they're working. And we don't just judge trade by whether we export a lot. That's like saying you went to the supermarket and I paid a lot. Boy, am I ever happy. We judge trade by what we can buy cheap. In other words, you know, the half of the benefits from trade come from us being able to buy things cheaper. So look at all the many things we get, the cell phones, just the incredible number of things we get that are made in other countries. Those are benefits of trade. And what I hear Jason doing, and it always makes me nervous, and by the way, Bush's own trade advisor talks the same way, although I think he knows better, is they always talk about the benefits of trade as if all the benefits are in the export sector. That's half the benefits. The other half of the benefits are on imports, being able to buy things cheaper. And among the things we buy cheaper are things that are inputs into our manufacturing process. Bush's tariffs on steel badly hurt industries that use steel.
But politically, David Henderson, might it be that Americans just assume at this point low prices at Walmart and everywhere else, but they've learned not to assume that they'll have their job, that it could move overseas?
Well, that might be, and then what people like me need to point out is there's a connection there, that yes, you have a somewhat higher chance of your job moving, but you have a certainty of getting low prices on many, many items and not just on the ones that you produce.
Let me take another call. Jim is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm located here in a sector of the country that has had a very, very slow recovery. It didn't
Yes.
completely recover, and a lot of tech jobs were lost.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working as a production manager of a small company that's a startup. Now, one of the interesting things that nobody seems to take into account is that from the time a law is passed, after all the talking, it takes from 3 to 5 years before the effect of that law is seen by the person who gets the paycheck.
There's always a lag time, true.
Yes. Now, how is that basically going to affect this election, since the stuff that is now happening is quite a bit of the production of the Clinton-era economics and not actually the Bush-era economics?
For good and for ill. Let us pick it up. Jim McTagg, what do you say to that, both from what has been inherited and looking ahead? You write that even if John Kerry should beat Bush, he wouldn't be able to even implement major tax policy until probably 2006 if he could get it through Congress. So,
we have a tax stimulus plan in effect. Kerry, in a sense, is saying, I want tax stimulus too, but we're going to reconfigure it. And it would take him at least a year or two, assuming he could get Congress to go along to get anything done. But he wouldn't get it done because it would be a Republican Congress, number one. Number two, 2 years from now, the economy will probably be entirely different. So this whole discussion might be moot. You know, we might see the effects of growth at that point. But I think time is on Kerry's side and not Bush's side.
Because the jobs haven't shown up in political terms fast enough for George Bush.
Right. And here's another thing. You know, in August and September, that's when parents write tuition checks.
Mm-hmm.
The stock market better be up in August and September when they go to their savings accounts to write those tuition checks.
Or it's really going to hurt.
I mean, yeah, Bush really does have time running against him.
Jason Furman, very quickly, our time is running down here. On the federal deficit, John Kerry says he can lick it. How's he going to do that?
That's a central part of his plan for the economy, is to restore confidence and bring long-term interest rates down and prevent them from rising by bringing the deficit down. And part of that involves repealing the tax cuts for the very wealthiest Americans, the top 2% of Americans that make over $200,000 a year. And that will restore confidence, and that's one of the factors that may be making firms more reluctant to invest in hire more workers today.
And David Henderson, we've just got half a minute. I'm sorry for that. But what's your level of confidence that George Bush can come anywhere near his promise to cut the deficit in half by the end of his next term?
I don't have a lot of confidence in that, because he hasn't yet vetoed a spending bill. And that's one of the key indicators. I think he's been very soft on spending. And so, I just am not very confident in that.
Well, it's just a first look we've got at this tonight. There'll be much more on the table before the vote comes. We thank all of you for joining us tonight and helping us peek in here. David Henderson at the Hoover Institution, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Jason Furman, advisor to the Kerry campaign, former policy director for Wesley Clark, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Jim McTagg, with your terrific article in Barron's, thanks a lot for joining us. Jim McTagg, Washington editor for Barron's Magazine, thanks for being with us.
A real pleasure. Thanks.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the early battle in battleground states. This is On Point. The campaigns of Senator John Kerry and President George W. Bush have apparently agreed on the 18 battleground states that are likely to determine the November election. Kerry's first television ads target 16 of those states, while Bush's new ads cover all 18. This electoral calculus means that for voters in much of the country, the 2004 campaign will be waged far from their hometowns. But in those 18 toss-up states, the battle has already begun. Longtime political observer Ann McPheeters is covering the presidential campaign for newspapers in two battleground states, Pennsylvania and Ohio. In this radio diary, she says that for her readers, the race is on.
You know it's an election year when Laura Bush, who made her husband promise she'd never have to give a political speech, now has as many public appearances and nearly as many opinions as her husband. It's an election year when Teresa Heinz Kerry smiles brightly at her sixth campaign stop of the day and works hard at looking as if she'd rather be nowhere else but at the candidate's side, hearing the same speech she's now heard perhaps 14,572 times. It's that time of the quadrennial calendar when it's impossible to turn on a TV without hearing, "I'm George W. Bush, and I approved of this message." It's an election year when the requests for political donations outnumber the bills in your mailbox. You know it's going to be a long 7.5 months when the twists and turns of Martha Stewart's life take backstage to Dennis Kucinich's stomach problems. You know it's election time when your phone rings and it's Arnold Schwarzenegger or Barbara Streisand or Ed Gillespie or Terry McAuliffe, and you're really flattered for 10 seconds until you realize you're listening to a computer. You know it's an election year when you have to ease into the intersection because of all those dueling yard signs. It's election time when you realize you had no idea your neighbor was so dense and easily manipulated after you've seen him put up a yard sign for one of the stupidest candidates in American history. You pray nobody thinks it's your sign and muse about getting rid of it after midnight. It's election time when you no longer get excited that John Kerry or President Bush is coming to your town because you've already taken time off work to meet them twice. It's an election year when your TV channel breaks in on regular programming with breathless updates via Election Watch or The Nation Chooses or Parade of Candidates on a primary you didn't know was happening in a state you haven't thought about in 4 years. You know it's all politics all the time when you have a dinner party and two guests get into a shouting match about whom Kerry should pick as his running mate. And when you go to your dentist, he waits until your mouth is wide open and stuffed with dental machinery so you can't say a word, and then he lectures you on why his candidate is a paragon of virtues and yours, well, is too evil to take seriously. And every 4 years, the candidates vow no negativity and no dirty tricks, just substance and honest debate, the kind that the good people of this country deserve, they say. And then you hear nothing from the candidates about their opponents but how they flip-flop, rush to bad judgments, forgot about hard-working Americans struggling to make ends meet, are captive of big business, and are secretly working to undermine Social Security. But never mind. It's the way of politics in America. We routinely fret about making changes, but except for quarreling over the best way to count our votes, we basically do the same things year after year. And after we vote, we spend the next 4 years complaining about the results. Hey, it's what we do.
Ann McPheeters is National Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and the Toledo Blade. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.